Richard, I forgot to apologize to you for last week, implying that you stole my pen. When I opened up my briefcase this morning, there it was. And I apologize. And I want you to know I had nothing to do with keying your car last week. I think it was Les. Joining me today is real estate teaching guru, Dwayne Gomer. He was teaching classes for real estate agents to get their real estate license, and I think just after the Civil War. He's been around a long time. He's recognized as a leader in California real estate continuing education, license renewals, notary commissions. Dwayne Gomer, D-U-A-N-E, DwayneGomer.com, you can find him. Provides courses for thousands of Californians to qualify for sales and broker's license and procedures, state-of-the-art, internet testing, automatic grading, certificate printing, website, anything you want. Welcome back to Radio Real Estate, Dwayne Gomer.
Okay, thank you. And I just want to add that Abraham was not a very good student.
I don't want to say you're old, but no, you've been, and I do, I don't know if we spoke about this, but your dear friend who came on the program several times, who was a broker and a teacher, passed away.
Yes.
And we should...
Bob Hunt passed away, and it was a very sad thing. He was a great... His big forte was his writing was so good. He was a great writer and columnist, and it was really good to, you know, meet with him, and he passed away way too early.
And you introduced me to him. I was reading him for over the years, and then he came on the program once or twice, so we'll dedicate today's program to the memory.
To the memory of Robert Hunt.
Robert
good,
Hunt.
Good choice.
So we've got a few things to cover, and one of them is judicial foreclosure. You got an update on some lending rules. Why don't we start there with lending rules?
The biggest one is on the VA. The rules are just put in effect, I believe, the end of October. I think it was October 24th. They were having a lot of trouble on VA loans where the lenders were serial refinancing them, and they would convince the borrower, the veteran, to a veteran or service person to take another loan, and they were just doing it just way too often. So the government came up with a rule called anti-churning, and so now if anybody is going to refinance a VA loan, they have to show many more disclosures to the borrower. For example, they must show, and they cannot do it constantly unless they're getting a better interest rate or they're converting it to a fixed or whatever. And one of the other things that is really good that's going to help the veteran is that they must, when they're doing a refinance of a loan, they have to show them what their equity is before they go into the loan and what their equity is after they close the loan. And so these new rules will help a lot in eliminating scamming and so on. And one other thing is the limits at to which somebody can get a veteran's loan have increased greatly. I mean, up to $1 million in some cases. So even people in Santa Barbara County could get a veteran loan on some of their properties now.
Well, that's very exciting to hear on the VA loans. And we want, as you mentioned, they weren't always able to work in higher-priced homes. So I'm glad to hear that increase. And the anti-churning law, I like the spelling out of your equity before and after. And of course, the problem with refinancing is, you pay off, your loan, number of years left on your loan comes down, and then you refinance and you probably trigger up to another 30-year loan. I heard an LA station advertising, and they were trying to promote that if you have a 30-year loan and you have 18 years left, they'll want to refinance you with an 18-year loan so you don't add to your number of years, but then it's tougher to keep the payment down.
Yeah, the payment would be much higher. Anytime you reduce the years, the payment goes up. So it's a kind of a catch-22.
So good update on the VA loans. We've got a few initials to work on. FHA loans. Tell us what FHA loans are and the spot approval that's come out.
Okay. FHA loans are obviously the under HUD, and so they have a lot of advantages. They have a 3.5% down payment, which works a lot in expensive homes. And then they do have mortgage premium payments, but they've been a mainstay of first-time buyers who are the main source of success in the real estate business. We have to have first-time buyers, and so FHA loans help a lot. And what happened is you could make FHA loans in single homes, but many people living in condominiums wanted to get FHA loans. And that's a good source of financing, and it would help increase the prices possibly. But what happened is a few years ago, the FHA came out and said all the HUD, condo projects must get approved by HUD. And it's kind of a comprehensive process. They're trying to protect the buyers and everything. So they would look at the project, and they would look to see how their reserves were, what the condition of the project was, what their management situation is. And another thing they would look at is how many units in the building, in the project, are rented. And they didn't want to have too high a percentage of rentals in any project. So they were having a real problem because they came out and said you must get reapproved, and many of them, they did not do it because of the cost. And so, therefore, many people wanted to sell their home, or a buyer wanted to get an FHA loan, and they could not because the project was not approved. So now they've come out with a new situation where you can get condo approval on a single house. And so that... that's called spot approval. And so you go in, and the real estate lending official or the real estate agent will help get spot approval of that one house, and then the person can use FHA financing.
Right. Spot approval for the one condo unit within the condo complex, so they can...
Correct.
I like that. I like that.
And much simpler and can be much quicker and can be used in a real estate transaction.
I want to backtrack to what you said initially when you talked about 3.5% down and mortgage premium payments, mortgage insurance payments. And a lot of people aren't familiar with that, but it can occur when a borrower is not putting 20% down, and so they have to have insurance. And that adds to the cost on a monthly basis.
Quite a bit. But that's one of the reasons. But still, if you're trying to look at even a low-priced condo in many areas, let's say it's not in Santa Barbara County, but in other counties, you might find a condo for $400,000. At 20% down, you got to come up with $80,000. And 3.5% down, you're in the $14,000 range. And that's a lot easier to get a down payment and get started.
Now, a lot of times people will come in with 10% down, and they'll get a secondary loan of 10%, call it 10, 10, and 20.
90, 10, right.
90, 10, or 80, 10, and 10, where they get another 10% from someone else. Do you know, did the requirements for mortgage insurance, has that relaxed on some of those type of loans?
No, it is not relaxed at all. In fact, they're kind of tightened up getting rid of it. There's normally been if the amount of the equity increased, you could ask to get the mortgage insurance removed. But no, they have not loosened in that case at all.
My guest is Dwayne Gomer. He is, you can find him at DwayneGomer.com. He does this great newsletter. You don't have to be a real estate agent to get on his newsletter mailing list. Just talking about different issues in real estate. And he is a continuing education real estate guru, Dwayne Gomer, DwayneGomer.com. We're going to talk about foreclosures, judicial foreclosure versus...
Trustee sale.
And
the thing, a lot of people fear judicial foreclosures. In fact, when the chaos was here in 2009-ish, a lot of people would say, oh, my God, they're going to take my house and they're going to do this. But almost all of the foreclosures that were done on homes were trustee sales. And on trustee sales, they cannot get a judgment deficiency. That is one of the rules of a trustee sale. They put the trustee sale regulations into the code in California so that the lenders could foreclose faster. And one of the conditions was is that they could not get a judgment deficiency.
And define what that means.
If it happens, like, let's say, judicial foreclosure, you could get a judgment deficiency on a judicial foreclosure. I have a large apartment house, and so you decide to go ahead with a judicial foreclosure, go to court, take all the time, a year and a half, all the expenses, but at the end, then, you can get a judgment deficiency, which means that if the sale price when it's sold does not cover the loan plus all the costs, then the borrower owes that money, and it can. So most of the time, I have a question in my class when I'm teaching a class on this: is that the only time I've ever seen a judicial foreclosure is when there's a large project, a lot of money involved, and the owner of the property is somewhat wealthy, because there's no reason for going after somebody if they don't have the money to pay a judgment deficiency. But the offshoot of getting a judgment deficiency means that you have to go to court. It can be time-consuming and expensive. And then after you get the judgment, let's say that the judgment deficiency, you get it on November 15th. In most cases, I have 1 year to still stay in the property and still live in the property, and at any time during that 1 year, I have the right to redeem the property. So judicial foreclosures have a lot of problems.
But generally, in California, when someone gets a loan, can they be faced with a judicial foreclosure, or is it written so the type of loan they get, versus like a non-recourse or a recourse loan? How does that work?
If you buy a property, anytime you buy a property and the loan is used to buy or improve a property, that then means that it is a non-recourse loan, and they can't get a judgment deficiency even if they go through a judicial foreclosure. So many of these cases where people in Ceres and San Bernardino were worrying, they all had non-recourse loans. And so the lenders could not come and get a judgment deficiency no matter what they did.
The only troubling part about that, a lot of people were using just intentionally not making payments during the heyday, even though they could afford it.
Yes.
And I can't remember.
Called a strategic default.
Thank you. I couldn't remember that name. And I'm so glad they made this nice name.
Yeah, strategic default.
Doesn't it sound...
You and I might be on different sides of the street on that. I'm a believer that in cases that in that situation, that the person should take and do a strategic default. In my classes with lenders, I teach our biggest money maker right now is mortgage loan originators. They have to take continuing education. And we'll discuss this, somebody will say, well, these people made a promise to pay. And I said, that's not quite true. I said, what happened in that case and on all these foreclosures is the lender and the borrower made a contract. And the contract said that if the borrower does not pay, the lender can come in and take the property. And all these lenders knew they were making non-recourse loans, and so therefore I don't want to make the payments anymore. Here's the house. That's the contract you made, Mr. Lender. And if I was a legitimate person and made a 20% down payment, all of a sudden my house is valueless, and I have a house that I have a loan of $400,000, and the house is worth $250,000. I think it's sometimes a good. You don't owe complete alliance to a lender. You owe alliance to your own family, and so I believe there are times when the strategic default should be used.
Well, that's an interesting side of the coin. I remember seeing something on 60 Minutes, and this was a long time ago, because of course the number of foreclosures and short sales have just dried up to next to nothing.
Yes.
Compared to where we were several years back. And they were highlighting these people. I think some of them were in Arizona. And very wealthy people. And they got stung. You know, they bought and the market tanked. And they were making the point that it wasn't fair to the lender. And you're arguing...
Here's my point.
Go ahead.
The lender made the loan. The lender had an appraiser go out and appraise the loan. They had a loan processor handle the loan. Then they had an underwriter. So the lender made the loan knowing there were risks. The risks are not on the borrower. They're on the lender. And all these people, all those five, six people, plus a real estate agent, plus a mortgage loan originator, they told that person in Arizona, this is a good buy. Now, a lot of them are scam artists. I mean, if you see the movie Short Sale, you know many were. But a high percentage of these people were just nice people that got caught in something. And the lender now, they were all saying, well, the borrower assumes the risk. No, lender, you made the loan. You weren't forced to make the loan. You made the loan. That's my theory.
Interesting.
And I have a lot of disagreement when I'm teaching classes.
A lot of people, right. So the opposite side of the coin would be that they signed a promissory note.
Signed a contract.
Signed a contract.
There's a phrase. You want another phrase that's a good one? That's what's called strategic default. There's another phrase in law that a friend of mine who's a judge taught me, and that's called efficient breach. And it says that it's not illegal sometimes to breach a contract, even though there might be a penalty, but the penalty will not be as severe. Now, the other thing that everybody said back then was, oh, my God, if you go through foreclosure, you will never be able to get another loan. And you and I know that wasn't true. Person could get, shortly after the chaos, somebody could go out and get a loan even if they had a foreclosure on their record.
There would be a period of time where they couldn't?
Yeah, what was it, a year or 2 years? Lenders are going to lend. They're not ever going to not lend. And so they didn't even look at whether the person had a FFR. So you got two phrases, strategic default and efficient breach.
And the efficient breach, and I'm remembering that it was a longer period of time. I thought it was several years before it would be removed from your credit and a lender would...
Oh, removed from the credit, 7 years.
That's what
but
I remember.
FHA came back after, I believe, 18 months and started making loans to people who had foreclosures.
Is that right? My
guest,
Dwayne Gomer. So efficient breach, and you said it's not necessarily illegal to breach a contract. Under what circumstances?
If you breach a contract, there are penalties. Correct?
Yes.
Let's say that I have a contract, and this is not just real estate. There are cases where you have a contract, and if you breach the contract, there are going to be penalties. Excess payments, another increase in interest. But many times, breaching the contract is a good business decision, and that's called efficient breach.
You'll learn something new every day.
Look it up. It's got interesting reading.
I like it. Just strategic default and efficient breach. My guest, Dwayne Gomer. You can find him on DwayneGomer.com. You can get his newsletter if you just want to read read via your email. Just go to DwayneGomer.com.
What I would recommend is they go to the blog and see if they like my emails. The blog is DwayneGomer.info.
DwayneGomer.info.
Just go to my blog. They could see it, and if they like it, they can then. It's just an easy way to send in to just click on the button, and they can get it. By the way, I know the time is, but let me ask you one more question. You might find interesting in my classes. For a trustee sale foreclosure, the bid is $200,000. That's what the lender wants, and there's no other loan except the lender's. Somebody comes in and bids $240,000, so there's $40,000 extra. There's an IRS lien on the property. Does the IRS lien get any of the $40,000?
I'll guess no.
They don't. And,
which is
IRS
counterintuitive.
The IRS lien is wiped off this property for somebody buying. The only recourse that IRS has on that property is they can, during the next 120 days, they can buy it back from the winning bidder. But other than that, it's wiped off the property. Now, it's not wiped off the former owner, who's still going to have that IRS lien. But as far as the property, it's sold without the IRS lien, and it's wiped off.
That's very interesting. I knew the, I should have guessed that they, that the IRS wins, because I didn't know there was a case where they wouldn't win.
Yes, right. You'd think they always win. In a class, I had a class the other day, we had 80 people. I think 78 said the IRS would get the money. So it's a, it's one of the myths that I call it, myth of foreclosures.
The myth of foreclosures, and but and was that related to bankruptcy? That's not related to bankruptcy.
No, it's got nothing to do with bankruptcy. Bankruptcy is a whole different situation where somebody can slow down a foreclosure, either type. They can slow it down, and then the lender's got to go to court and get a release from the bankruptcy. And normally when there's no equity in the property, a lender can get a release from the bankruptcy fairly easy.
Dwayne, always great to talk to you. I think you had one quick thing to talk about, Assembly Bill 5.
Which one?
AB 5.
Assembly Bill 5. The only thing I wanted to say on AB 5, a lot of people are worrying about it, but CAR was worked very hard, and one of the exemptions under AB 5 for independent contractors is real estate agents can be paid. Real estate agents can be paid as independent contractors. So that's set in AB 5 as an exemption. Also, insurance agents are, mortgage loan originators are not exempt. So that's a little technicality on it. But for your real estate agents and your people, they better be very careful and get advice when they start paying unlicensed assistants as independent contractors. It could be very, they could have problems.
Could be recourse.
Yep, it's recourse.
It's not a non-recourse loan.
Yep.
It's a recourse
loan. What it is you have to pay their Social Security, and it gets very expensive.
What if the real estate agent also works as Uber? Is he an independent contractor there as well?
Only in real estate-related events. It's very classified. It can be paid. I think I have a problem paying my speakers as independent contractors.
Dwayne Gomer, thank you so very much. When we send the check, we'll make you an employee for appearing on the program, I promise.
Very good.
With benefits, insurance, you get the whole nine yards.
Okay, onward and upward, okay?
Dwayne Gomer, you can find him online and find his blog at, what is it again?
DwayneGomer.info.
Thanks, Dwayne. Thanks.
Okay,
good to talk,
Mark,
to you.
Thanks, good. And let's get that broker's license.
I will. Thank you for prodding me on that. I will.
I'll prod you. I'll put down 60 days on a recall. I'll be your Pinocchio.
I need someone to push me. Thank you.
I'll see
you. Thank you. Bye-bye. I have 5 of the 8 college courses, and he wants me to take the other 3, and I've been meaning to do it. Mark Schneidman's Radio Real Estate, RadioRealEstate.com. How about earnest money deposit scam, talking about losing money, strategic default? That was interesting that he took the other side of the coin there. And let's see what they have to say on, and maybe even a real estate story. Mark Schneidman's Radio Real Estate, where we retort and you deride.